What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning in to the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, and I have another special show for you today. On the phone with me, I have an industry veteran who began his 40-year career in the music business as a singer-songwriter. Since then, he's released three albums, been an award-winning songwriter and journalist, the creative director of MCA Music, and also helped bring karaoke from Japan to North America and Western Europe. Please put your hands together and welcome singer-songwriter, licensing, and publishing expert, Mike Milius. What's going on, Mike?
It's so good. Thanks for having me on the show, Spud. It means a lot to me, man.
Oh, man. Pleasure's all mine, man. It's just very special for you to be on the show. You and I go way back. We have some history together, man. And just to bring you on my platform, it's just truly an honor. Thank you.
Well, I mean, given the guests you've had, you put me in good company, Spud, so thanks.
Oh, good deal, man. So, Mike, give me some history of how when you started in the music business and venturing off into the background and the corporate side of music with licensing and publishing.
Well, I started out as a singer-songwriter, and that evolved into me having my first album out on Universal Records. I was a staff songwriter for Peer Music. Which is still remains one of the largest independent music publishing houses in the world. And I was, a staff songwriter there, and they got me a deal with Universal. I had my first album released in 1968. It was called Mike Milius Desperado. It sold like about 10 copies. I think my mother bought them all, And but show you how crazy, kooky, nutty the business is. That was 68. In 95, Beck, with his Ode to Lay album, Beck found a copy in a bin in L.A. and sampled some of the vocals. So you never know what's going to happen. It's never over in this business, and especially in music publishing. You just have to believe in songs, and you'll find homes for them.
That's amazing, man. Like you mentioned, coming from the musical side of songwriting and as an artist, there's so many different avenues that a person can take and still be creative. If it's not performing, it's in the background of licensing and publishing. So yeah, I totally agree with you.
Well, yeah, there really is a creative part of music publishing, because what a publisher does, as you know, Spud, and just for your listeners, is he'll find a song, and you have to listen to everything. I mean, I bought, when I was at MC, I bought songs over the phone from Italy. I mean, I bought the Laura Branigan hit, I became the Laura Branigan hit Gloria, over the phone. It was a guy named Roberto Tosi had a hit with that song, and we took the melody and did a new English lyric to it. And you just never know. You just have to believe in a song, and then you do what is called casting, just the way you'd cast a director would cast, a producer would cast an actor or an actress for a movie or a TV show. You have to think in terms of casting the song. If the song right for this artist, or is the song right for this music supervisor who has a scene in a film or a TV show? And you really have to spend some time on that. And if you have your casting down, the people who you're pitching to will remember that. And even if it's not the right song for a project, if you have your casting down, they'll get back to you again for the next project.
Wow. Having that creative background as a singer-songwriter, Mike, I mean, who were your musical influences growing up, and, kind of laid that map of musicianship that you wanted to follow into your own career?
Well, I tell you, I always put my inspirations as Mae West, Little Richard, and Woody Guthrie.
Wow. That's a good combination, man.
Yeah, right. No, but I mean, Little Richard inspired me, because he just blew it all out, and I love Woody Guthrie's lyrics. They were very meaningful stuff. And then Dylan came along and just completely rewrote songwriting. I mean, to my knowledge, American songwriting was Stephen Foster, way back in the day before the turn of the century, and then Irving Berlin, and then Bob Dylan. Those are the three guys I think that created American songwriting, and as they came along with their work, it changed the playing field. Big game changers, all three of those guys. So you'd have to cite Stephen Foster, Irving Berlin, and then Bob Dylan. A lot of other stuff in the meantime too, a lot of meaningful writers. Sam Cooke was one, and some of the great stuff. But I think between those three writers, it really laid the pipe for how songwriting evolved. of course. Now, that being said, there's a lot of other plays that came, a lot of other forces that came into play, like the rhythm of things, the grooves, and that's just a whole other ballgame. We'd be here all night talking about the subtleties of that. But that's what made it exciting. I mean, going from, swing to rock and roll to R&B and all the roots and, that they're all connected by. So it's a beautiful thing being in this business, man.
Oh, definitely. You know, Mike, with your diverse background as a music listener and also a creative musician, as a singer-songwriter and musician, how do those influences and that experience of listening to different types of styles translate into your creative director for MCA Music?
Well, you just have to listen to everything. I mean, no matter who. I was famous at MCA for doing that. Some guy would have a song, you want to make an appointment, I'd say, play me the song over the phone. And I'd critique it over the phone, what it was, I'd say, let me hear the song and pick up the receiver again after the first verse and chorus,
Right.
And it's just a sheer love of the music, having been doing it for 45 plus years. Creatively, it's more like an intuitive thing after a while. Listening to a song, just like we think in terms of like what makes a song tick, having like a staccato verse and a legato chorus, like dynamic changes from verses to choruses, and trying to say more with less words, and not repeating yourself in a song, and because songwriting is an art and a craft, and the art always comes first, because that's your inspiration. That's where you get the fire in the belly from. Mm-hmm. And then you wind up, honing that art with your craft, and hopefully you'll have a hit. I mean, you can never second guess what is going to be a hit or isn't going to be a hit. Because basically, it, takes a lot of promotion and the right artist, but, there are some songs that can be recorded over and over again until it comes, with the right arrangement and the right artist, and then it gets some action. But it's so exciting.
It is, man. Talk about the song structure and knowing when to come in and out with your choruses and the leads and the bridge. Is there a specific formula that you like to hear and see on records these days, or it depends on the track? I mean, sometimes we can really step outside the box and, get outside the 16-bar verse and the 8-bar chorus. I mean, is your ear really tuned to what's on the radio, or are you one of the guys who's like, man, if it's a good song, it's a good song?
Well, if it's a good song, it's a good song. But after that being said, Spud, it also has to be a good record. The production has to be there. I mean, production's so sophisticated now. You can have hit records that aren't necessarily, great songs, but they're great grooves and they're great records and they're great productions, and you fall in love with it,
Right.
A lot of the things he'd break down into a piano or a guitar vocal, he wouldn't make it. But within the context of the great sophisticated production techniques that are available and that are exercised today, it's more possible to make a mediocre thing sound really superlative.
Nice.
Which is exciting. I remember back in the day in the early 80s when a fellow walked into my office with a Lim drum machine. And, it was good and bad. A lot of people complained that writers aren't going to write to melodies anymore. They're going to write to grooves. But at the same time, it brought a lot of people into it. I think that opened up the field to rap, which is a great American art form. I mean, rap is heavy as jazz was in its day when it first came on the scene, and people would say, oh, I don't like that jazz. It's,
right.
The devil's music, whatever they say. And rap got a bad rap, no pun intended, still to this day, but it's an important music form. And I think rap really was able to evolve based on things like a drum machine happening,
Oh, totally, man. And like I said, a lot of guys now, younger guys, I mean, they're not even familiar with the Lynn drum, man. Lynn drum was just,
Yeah, that's what the Columbus brought over, man.
But, interesting, man, is just how a non-musician can pick up a drum machine, and I feel personally that everybody has a sense of rhythm inside of them.
Oh, definitely goes with your heartbeat, man.
Oh, totally. I mean, we're in rhythm when we walk. I mean, just as daily living thing that we do in a rhythm, and just to be able to translate those life experiences on a drum machine is kind of like the first introduction to music or an instrument. And, you know, technology allows the non-musician to take advantage and really express himself on the drum machine box. So, yeah, I agree with you. And it's evolved to even bigger and better things now, you know, from 20 years ago. So, yeah, I totally agree with you.
Well, see, this is what makes it so real. And just as, you know, we've become like an instant gratification society and cultures, but it's that much more of a facile effort to create a record, to write a song, to create a work of art, to create a piece of intellectual property. And that's what I want. First thing I want to tell writers nowadays is that just as way a guy who's a construction or an engineer can build a house or an apartment, and that's a property. The same thing when a guy sits down at a piano, his guitar, or a drum machine, and creates a song, that is a property. That is an intellectual property, and that has value depending on how extensively it's exploited. And it's really important for the guys nowadays coming up to register with the right societies, get with ASCAP, get with BMI, and get your songs registered. Get them copyrighted. And realize that what you've created, even though it's come from out of thin air and it's not and the only tangible thing is going to be your copyright form, it's a piece of property. It's an equity. And, you know, to this day, music publishing has always been the cornerstone of, income in the whole entertainment business, long after the records aren't being played, long after the acts on touring or passed on, those songs still live on. And that's where most of the money comes from. That's how McCartney became a billionaire. That's how Michael Jackson made his money, you know, buying catalogs. And you have to think in terms of, for every dollar, if you take all the copyrights in the world from every country, okay, and you put into a dollar, about 75% of that dollar would be American copyrights.
Wow.
Gives you a sense of the value of it. And forget about arms and cars and farms and whatever. The American copyrights have consistently been the only American export that's always had a trade surplus. Wow. At the end of the day, it's the most valuable American export.
You know, speaking of music licensing and publishing, Mike, explain to me how the process works for song submissions for TV and film placements. How does that start from the beginning to the end? I mean, what do you do when you receive a project, and what do you do to take the song selections, and how the licensing and publishing works at that point?
Yeah, what is it? You'll have tip sheets. The song plug or song link are both good, or Lenny Carico's New on the Charts is another good one. But also you can get a list through the Hollywood Reporter. Once a year they do an issue that lists all the music supervisors in the business who are working on the TV and the movies, TV shows and movies. And what they do, music supervisor is sent out by the producer to find songs, a theme song, different songs for different scenes, underscoring, and then he'll put the word out to publishers. He knows the publishers will call them saying, what are you looking for? And they'll give you a scene. And they, here again, Sputter comes in where you have to cast the right song for the right scene. Like years ago, when the TV show Sopranos first came out, I got a lead from the music supervisor, and I just went through a whole bunch of, they gave me an idea, sort of like trip hop, you know, urban thing. And so I sent him a song called Slide Slide, and there wasn't much to say. They just say looking for, you know, unknown songs, you know. Mm-hmm. So I sent the song Slide Slide. And it wound up in the Sopranos, in the Bada Bing thing where the girl was sliding, you know, at strip club where she was sliding on a pole.
Right.
I have no idea. It's a funny story because the fellow who's producing the show said, you know, okay, I'll take this song. Was negotiating the advance. I can't give you an advance for it because I've maxed out my parents' credit cards producing the pilot.
Wow.
So he said, but if I use the song in the show, he said, I'll use the song and if the show hits, I'll pay you top dollar. And he did. I got top dollar from the guy. I mean, I can't tell you what that song has made. I mean, they used it for like 35 seconds and it's probably in excess of $50,000. And
wow.
Sync fees over the years just for that one song and that one show.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it can be very lucrative for that. So, you know, what will happen then is if they accept your song, and be careful with cash. If you don't have any sense of casting, they're just looking for songs, you know, generically, just give it your best shot. A tool will be what you like. If they give you a sense of the scene, really analyze and figure what song would be best cast for that scene, and then get the tune to them. Nowadays it's easy because you can send MP3s, you know?
Sure.
So it's a lot easier. And then they'll get back to you, and they'll request a sync license, which is a synchronization license, being that your song will be fixed up with the visual of what's on the screen. So that's called a sync license. And a sync license, you can negotiate anything. Where in the case of mechanical license, which is the audio only, that's the standard rate of 9.1 cents as it is now. And you can't charge more, but you can give a guy a break, you know, if you have to with something, if he only uses like half the song. But a sync license is completely negotiable. You can, like, you know, the like Led Zeppelin got something like $8 million for, you know, the Cadillac commercial for rock and roll, you know. Mm-hmm. Or the Stones using, you know, licensing Start Me Up for, you know, for to Microsoft, you know, it's probably a $10 million license. Wow. For that use. So, yeah, sync is big bucks. But the long ball money over the years is really going to, it comes down to your performance royalty, which is, they call the PROs, the Performing Rights Organizations, which is your ASCAP and BMI in this country, you know, SACEM in France. And there are, I think there are like 217 performing rights societies, and basically every country in the world is represented in some way or another by one. You might have one company like GEMA in Germany, also covers Austria and Switzerland, but it's, you know, it's like over $10 billion a year from PROs paid out to all the writers and publishers. Wow. And that is the money that's collected when your song is played on the radio, on television, which is another fee in addition to sync license, or any public performance, any public venue, like your local pizza parlor, your nightclub. They will have to have, if they play a radio or have a jukebox, they have to have a performing rights license.
Now, do you find more these days that instrumentals from unknown artists are being placed on radio and TV, or are you still getting a lot of the older songs from back in the day?
That really comes down to the budget. If they can afford a Rolling Stones song or something, you know, they'll go for it. If they can, but usually, as Sopranos was one of the first things to do it, they call it source music. So they'll try to use as many unknown songs as they can. And, you know, they can become hits, too, you know, out of use if it's on a series, you know?
Sure.
But I think with the economy now, they are looking for, it's a great time for fledgling songwriters, but because with the economy, the shows are looking for unknown songs so they can get a better break on it, you know, and which is a better opportunity for the, you know, the startup songwriters.
Right. Now, speaking of songwriters, Mike, man, you've had some success with the song that you've written for Martin Luther King, and the title of it was The Ballad of Martin Luther King. How did how did that project come about, and, you know, what inspired you to write this song?
Well, that's funny. It inspired me to write the song. I wrote it the night Dr. King was assassinated, and it was one of those songs, was such a heartfelt thing that I never really pitched it, you know. It was like a labor of love. And it wound up on the cover of this magazine called Broadside Magazine, which was a topical song review that was published from 1962 to 1982. And they were the first ones to publish, like, Blowing in the Wind and Society's Child, Janiceean. And Pete Seeger found it from that. And then Pete Seeger recorded on a Sesame Street album. And it's been in a couple movies. It was in a songbook called Songs That Changed the World. And it's a steady income earner, but it's a funniest thing, Spud, because I never really pitched that song. It just, like, the word of mouth got on it. A lot of folk singers recorded it. And, I mean, there's other things I have that I pitched, you know, they got into movies that I've written. But that was just one of those labor of love things, and it's a really steady copyright. It was just like a no-nonsense song, and just got right to the point, you know. And, again, a labor of love. So it just, you know, was a fire in the belly kind of thing that, now, you know, I look forward to quarterly checks on it.
Man, you know, I think it's really cool that an artist will write a song, and it's just funny how other artists that are inspired by your work want to reproduce and recreate your work. I mean, because it's great work, and it's just, you know, an honor to have somebody recreate your song that you've written.
Yeah. And you never know. It's funny because before the internet, a lot of them fell through the cracks. But it's funny, I was checking on this song about 2 years ago, and I see this group called Daddy out of Nashville, And these guys wrote great songs, doing all their own material. And they recorded 11 songs, and 10 of them were songs they wrote themselves. And then the 11th was the Ballad of Martin Luther King. It's unlike anything else on their album,
Wow.
They do these really funny, clever things. And then that was just completely different from any of the material. The group's called Daddy, and independent group on independent label. So you never know when something like that's going to show up and knock me out. They're selling thousands of copies. They're touring. So it was yet another version of that song,
Wow, amazing.
So you never know what's going to happen.
Oh, totally. Now, Mike, I got to ask you firsthand, man, because you've been in the business 40-plus years, and, I speak to other musicians, and everyone's got their own personal opinions of how the business has changed from when it started up until now with the internet taking over. I mean, give me your first impression and the truth of how it's changed and how it's benefiting us instead of the negatives that we hear all the time.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Everyone says it's rough, it's getting rough, but, to me it was easy both ways, but in the sense that when I started out in the mid-60s, I could take my guitar and go up to the Brill Building in Manhattan or 1650 Broadway, and there were literally dozens and dozens and dozens of independent publishers. So I could, conceivably, and fortunately it happened more often than not, they play a song for a publisher, place it, get a $100 advance, he'd spend $100 on the demo, which was, $20 each for the bass, drum, guitar, vocalist and keyboard. You take an hour, they push up acid tapes, and it was much, the publishers and finding a home for your song and selling a song was infinitely more accessible than it is today. But that being said, and that, again, that's when there were, literally hundreds of publishers. Now you have basically four companies owning 99% of the copyright, so they're not looking for songs anymore, But given that condition, it's become much easier because of the internet to get your songs out there. You don't even need a record label anymore. You can get, something on YouTube and you're off. You get enough hits and you're in business.
Now, do you personally feel this is a strong, effective way to promote yourself as a band, artist, or producer using YouTubes and a lot of the internet websites? I mean, are a lot of record executives looking for that, or is this kind of like a stepping stone? And then you're moving up to a different side of marketing promotion. I mean, is this going to be the way to promote yourself going now?
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. I mean, I'm doing a lot of work in the Caribbean, bringing songwriters and artists up from down there. And the first thing the record company says to me, give me the YouTube link. Give me the MySpace link, give me his website. They don't want to. That does the work. I mean, guys used to, well, the A&R guy, A&R, still exists, but they don't function the way they used to. It's not like going to a club and finding an act or something,
Right.
It's like, what's going on? Let me see the video on YouTube. And that's how acts are signed. That there's enough hits, and then they got a happening website. You really need stuff on YouTube and a website. And then you can rock your career.
Now, with the internet flooding and, with the music downloads crashing the scene and a lot of the artists aren't getting paid, how do you feel this is going to be able to turn around? We'll be able to, profit from our creations and things.
Yeah, well, you're right. As well, we should. Well, that has turned around. I mean, Napster was a big threat, and Napster really was wacky. That really, savaged the whole deal the way it was. People losing money. But that's turned around, and fortunately, the copyright laws have prevailed. So people are paying the piper now. And it's much bigger action. I mean, you think in terms of it. But when I started out, the population of the world was just a little over 2 billion. Now it's close to 7 billion. So it's like more dribbles in the cage, There's more music, but at the same time, there's more outlets. And, there's a lot of noise out there, right?
Right.
But at the same time, there are more venues and more avenues and more opportunities for music to be used. I mean, little companies, little stores, little chains are putting out their own CD compilations now. I mean, Starbucks became a record store,
Right, yeah.
So it's good. People, who was the Eagles? They did an exclusive for their album, the last album, with Walmart,
Right.
So, record companies have disappeared, all gone, the record label, of record stores, rather, but more venues are are selling records, and you know, and it's all download. Most of it's download to begin with now off the web, and with the iPod, you know, it's that's become the new software.
You know, with your experience in releasing records and doing song placements, do you feel it's effective still to do a full album, or do you believe in the singles and EP direction these days?
Either way, all three are valid, but it just really depends on what the market will bear or what the fans demand, you know? There are a lot of people who go out with a single and stick with that, and then their careers change or go on to a TV show or something, you know, or become a movie star. And other people do an EP or an album. It just depends on what the traffic will bear. But I say one thing. I noticed that people are more single-oriented because a lot of the albums that have come out recently, they've just, you know, they had the one hit and the rest of it was just like filler. So what I've noticed is that people are getting more conscious of the concept of what they're doing when they do an album, and it's not, they know they can't get away with filler anymore. So I think it's just a better quality of music out there.
I agree. You know, I'm a firm believer. Is the filler is just, I think we can really take our time and do a complete album. I mean,
you have to.
You've got a huge fan base, and if you have established yourself as an artist, I mean, the fans are expecting something from you of good quality work. Why not give them 10 smash hits instead of, like you say, one or two songs and the rest of you just filler albums?
That is so true for so many reasons. You know, I mean, you got to give the fan, you got to give it back to the fans. And when you have, 10 smash hits on the album, then you got a better shot at the next single becoming a hit. You know, you can live off the album for a long time if you do a decent one.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
So, Mike, what is your musical agenda for 2011? What do we have on plate?
Pitching tunes. I'd be finding some great stuff in the Caribbean and little out islands, like down there in Anguilla, Nevis, St. Kitts. I mean, of course,
wow.
Jamaica's a gold mine. But these guys are incredible. I mean, down there, they have to knock themselves out. I mean, up here, I'll get maybe 10 CDs a week, and maybe out of the 10 CDs, I'll find one song. Down there, every CD I get has at least one song, if not three or four. That's great. And it's not just reggae or calypso or ska or soca anymore. The world has become such a small place, but that all their influences are coming out. These guys are doing R&B. They're doing power ballads. They're doing rap. Sometimes you can feel the threat of the Caribbean flavor with their grooves and everything, but these guys are not going to. That, to me, is the most unexploited hotbed of authentic talent in the Western Hemisphere. Material coming out of the Caribbean.
Wow.
I think that's going to be the next big thing.
But, you know, I always said, man, music is a universal language. I feel
it
that
sure is.
The influences, if you're an American and the music goes over to across the seas, I mean, they're going to receive that, and they're going to receive it just like we do. And, you know, to me, it's like I listen to artists that are, you know, maybe has an English accent, but if you listen to their singing, it's Americanized a lot of times. You know, you don't hear the accent.
Yeah,
it's like I don't hear your accent, man, until you start talking. You know, so it lets me know you listen to the American music. So
I know. It's funny. Well, a lot of the whole English invasion was based on American blues, you know.
Sure.
Doing that. Yeah, it's funny. That's funny. It reminds me of a story you talk about, you know, a guy sounded like blues musicians from the States with English accent when I was working with this company in Tokyo and we were bringing karaoke over here. I saw a fellow, a businessman, 2 o'clock in the morning, business suit, attaché case in one hand, microphone in the other, singing My Way. And he sang it perfectly. I mean, it was like Frank Sinatra all over again, you know?
Wow.
And after he got up the stage, like, man, that was the best My Way I ever heard. The guy didn't speak a word of English. He just had that record down so cold.
Wow.
That was it, you know?
Well, that's just, like I said, that ear, man. You know, we have an ear tones, and, you know, it just, like I said, just translate into that creative side of our brain. So, no, I can see that happening.
Well, you know, it's the best part of the industry to be in. I mean, the entertainment industry, because if you think about it, but, I mean, every aspect of the industry needs music, and that's not, the reverse is not true. I mean, every one of this, what they call the seven lively arts, is enhanced by music.
Totally.
And the opposite is not true, you know? So
right.
Music is what drives it, really.
Oh, all day long, man.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, it's been a true pleasure chopping it up with you, man. I'm just glad to talk to you for one, man. We haven't done this in a while, so it was just a true honor to have you on my show.
Yeah. It's been too long, Spud.
Oh, totally, man. You know, you already know you got a spot here at the Producer's Corner, and any project you got, pending in the future. You got to come back and chop it up with me again, Mike.
Let me know when you want me. I'm jumping at it, buddy. All right?
Sounds good, man. Have a safe 2011.
Bud. The best. Thanks,
right,
man.
Bye. Bye. And a big shout out and thank you to Mike Mealy's for coming on the show and chopping it up with me. You know, what's cool about Mike is that ever since I've known him, he's always had his ear to the street as, you know, what's going on and what's hot and what band is really popping. And, you know, just goes to show you, man, the years of experience and having your ear tuned to what's out there, not just in your favorite music that you like to listen to, but other styles and genres, man. This is really gives you that seasoned ear and keeping your ideas fresh and current to what's happening today and in the future. And to contact Mike Mealy, you can hit him up at millytunes@aol.com. millytunes@aol.com. And that's M-I-L-L-I tunes@aol.com. And for my past and current interviews, you can hit me up at www.spudtootight.com. www.spudtootight.com. And I'm also available on iTunes as a podcast, so if you have a Mac or a PC, an iPhone or an iPod or an iPad, open up the iTunes store, type in the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, and you'll have a list of my past and current interviews as well. And I want to thank everybody for tuning and listening in. Until next time, you guys keep it tight. Peace.